Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. It is Friday, the 25th of January, 2019. And, you know, I thought that it was possible, that it was just possible that as we started the program today, I might be able to share that the government shutdown was at least temporarily, do you suspend a shutdown? Like, I was hopeful that this announcement at 1 o'clock today was going to be that the U.S. government shutdown was at least ending temporarily, but I can't share that yet. I am certainly hoping that what is now well into the 35th day, I know that we have friends who work. I mean, they've been working, right? They've been working now for more than, wow, that's a long time. Three paychecks. They've missed three paychecks as of today. And so that's 6 weeks. So I don't know about you, but that would put an extreme burden on pretty much every family that I know, including my own. And so curious to know what kinds of tangible things you are seeing happening in your local communities. What is your church doing? What are you doing for your neighbors? I know that here in our local school district, there are real tangible efforts, not only to expand programs that are traditionally for just very low income students, but now extending those benefits to students from families whose, you know, parents work for the federal government. That's pretty extraordinary. I know that's happening here in our community. I also know that local churches here and really all over the country, I've actually seen it posted from an amazing number of places. Lots of folks out there collecting gift cards, particularly to grocery stores and restaurants, and then distributing those gift cards to federal employees who are either formally furloughed or those who are working every day but without a paycheck. I know that there are many of you across the country experiencing flight delays today, flight delays that started at LaGuardia and Newark and Philadelphia attributed to the shutdown are now creating a ripple effect across the country. And so what was an experience of only some Americans is very quickly by extension becoming an experience of all Americans. I have a nonprofit organization that I do some work for, and we needed a couple of questions answered by the IRS. And well, guess what? Good luck. There's nobody there to answer questions. I mean, there might be some IRS folks sending out letters that audits are in place and going to happen, but there's nobody there to help if you have a question right now about something related to a nonprofit or probably even a tax question related to filing. So there are lots of ways in which each and every one of us are affected by this partial government shutdown. And whatever your views are in terms of the responsibility, whoever bears the most responsibility, those who are elected in both houses of Congress and those who are elected at the highest levels of the executive branch of government, they bear a responsibility to find a solution and to work together to do that. And so let's be praying that a compromise is actually in the works and that the government gets back to work, particularly on these concerns related to safety and related to, you know, frankly, paying the members of, the military. Let's start with the Coast Guard. They're not getting paid right now. Just on and on. It's troublesome. It has now become long-term enough that it's extremely painful. It is beginning to impact the overall economy and not just the 1 million families directly affected by the fact that those government workers are not getting paid. So I am praying ardently in that direction that some solution would be found. And it would encourage you to be praying with me in that and encouraging others in that direction. Okay, I want to move to a headline out of Kentucky. And if you haven't already heard about Seven, a little boy named Seven, this is going to break your heart. And so let me just warn you in advance. This is just a genuinely tragic, heartbreaking story. It is a story of bullying. It's a story of the bullying of a chronically ill child. It's the story of bullying of a chronically ill child who is black. It's the story of the bullying of a chronically ill black child who is 10 years old and who could find, you know, frankly, insufficient help from adults to bring his suffering to an end. Took his own life. 10 years old. And so I'm gonna share with you from the Louisville Courier Journal, because that's actually the newspaper closest to the story. And this is about his mom. So his mom's name is Tammy Charles. By the way, his dad was at choir rehearsal at church when this took place. So just to give you a little bit of context, his mom was out running errands, and she gave Seven, who is 10 years old, three chores to do while she was out running those errands, and she returned to her home about an hour later. She found his writing assignment done. She found his clothes neatly hung in the closet, but the clean socks that he was supposed to pair up were still strewn across his bed. And so it looked as if he just stopped in the middle of those three chores and took his own life. Why would he do this? She says. Why would he do this? In her mind, she said she already had the answer. Her son could simply not take the bullying any longer. He was a fifth grader named Seven Bridges, and Donnie and Tammy are his parents, and they had called on the Jefferson County Public Schools to do more to stop the bullying that their son was experiencing on the bus and at school. At one point, he was choked to the point of passing out. He was called vile names. And this is a boy who, because of some issues related to the way that his digestive tract worked, he eventually had to be fitted with a colostomy bag. And so you can imagine the kind of horrifying bullying that he experienced. And so, first of all, I want to say to every child out there, bullying is wrong always and in all ways. And I want to say to anyone who is experiencing bullying, there is help, and you need to tell somebody, and you need to keep telling adults around you. And if you have any sort of thoughts of taking your own life, please call the Suicide Prevention Helpline at 1-800-273-8255. SuicidePreventionLifeline.org is available. There are lots of ministries out across the country that would be available to you as well. But please don't do the thing that cannot be undone. And so I want to say that, and I want to affirm life, and I want to have each and every one of us pray for this family. And one of the things that they are doing is they've come up with seven ways that that each and every one of us could engage in. Well, actually, they've come up with ways for people in their own community to engage. Maybe that's a better way to say it. Seven ways to sort of not only honor the life of this young boy whose name was Seven, but also to proactively engage in their community and bringing an end to, confronting and bringing an end to the bullying that is apparently has such a stronghold that these other young kids were treating this young boy in this way. And so I just thought, well, you know what? I bet we could come up with seven ways that we, no matter where we are, could become advocates for the kind of behavior that is appropriate. And we could intervene in those situations that we know are inappropriate. And there are all kinds of ideas out there. One of them is that you would actually take a no bullying pledge. And you say to yourself, what kind of difference would that make? It actually makes a huge difference to take a pledge to be the kind of person who absolutely will not bully anyone else and will not stand for the bullying of another person, that you absolutely would not stand by as a quiet witness, but that you would pledge to intervene. There's a pledge related to not watching programming, television programming or internet programming that includes the bullying of other people. You could join a Protectors Freedom Council. PFC is something that takes place in student-led groups all across the country. They exist in independent school districts as well as private schools. And it's through these student-led organizations that bullies actually are confronted by other kids. And that brings real radical change. You could anonymously report bullying when you see it. You could actually just simply be present in places where kids gather, like on playgrounds, like when there's a bunch of kids out somewhere. Don't move away from them. Actually move toward them. You could encourage positive behavior online. You could intervene in sports programs where bullying is often encouraged and actually modeled by, sadly, modeled by coaches. And you can do what's called lionizing courageous behavior. You can become a lion or a lioness for moral courage in your own community, in your own family, and in your own school district. So those would be some things just off the top of my head. I'm sure that there are others, not least of which, talk to your kids. Talk to your kids and ask them what they're experiencing. Talk to your kids and make sure they're not the bully. If your kid is the bully, intervene. Intervene and tell them this is not okay. This is spiritual warfare, and this is not a place where we're going to allow the enemy to have a foothold in our lives or in our hearts. Okay, friends, I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm actually going to re-air a conversation that I had with Paul Coughlin. He's the author of Free Us from Bullying, Real Solutions Beyond Being Nice. I want to re-air it now so that we are equipped again for this conversation. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith.
So if I stand, let me stand on the promise that you will pull me through. And if I can't.
Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I am joined in conversation now by Paul Coughlin. Paul is the founder and president of The Protectors. It's an official ministry partner of the Association of Christian Schools International, working to reduce adolescent and workplace bullying. He has helped thousands of children apologize for bullying during his Courage to Be Kind presentations. Paul is a former newspaper editor. His writing has appeared in numerous media outlets. And the book that we're going to be talking about today is Free Us from Bullying, Real Solutions Beyond Being Nice. Paul Coughlin, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
So this book opens with a heartbreaking story. But I think we better set the stage for the conversation today by having you describe the nature and scope of bullying in the culture. And then if you want to tell Alex Moore's story, I would invite you to do that.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we're familiar with the statistic that 160,000 kids stay home from school each day due to bullying. That's about 13 million a year. That stat comes from the middle 1990s, before cyberbullying was even a word. So that number of kids are being bullied is in the millions, and it is the leading form of child abuse in the nation and most likely the world. So it is huge. Most every child is affected by it, not just targets, but bystanders, because bystanders are harmed as well when they witness it. Their test scores, for example, go down. Alex Moore was a beautiful young lady there in Jamison, Alabama. And what happened to her was so extremely sad. And there's so many stories that we can pull from that. She did commit what we call bullycide. She jumped off of an overpass, sadly. But the one thing I wanted to point out with her story was that if someone had stood up for her, statistically, even one person, it could have fundamentally changed her life, because the power of the bystander when they become what we call a protector is so profound and so life-changing. Not only can it literally save the life of another kid, it changes the life of the person who becomes that protector. They become a bigger, stronger person. They become more Christ-like.
So one of the things I really appreciate about what you have done here is that you do help us see and understand what I would describe as kind of the array of characters involved. There is a victim of bullying. There is a bully. There are witnesses or bystanders. Those people can be equipped to become protectors. Bullies can be, an intervention can happen with them. They can be confronted, and things can change. So I would like to talk about some of those, some of the people in this sort of range of folks involved, because I think we tend to think of bullying as, first of all, a school problem. You completely dissuade us of that, and help us recognize that this is a culture problem. But there are lots of other misconceptions about bullying that you expose here. So why don't you talk a little bit about some of the misconceptions that we have about bullying today?
Yeah, there's so many of them. One is that it makes us stronger. Particularly, you'll hear this from men more than women during my community presentations. They'll say things like, "That which doesn't kill us makes us stronger." They think they're quoting the Bible. That's not. That's Friedrich Nietzsche, who hated the Bible, and who also said man is the cruelest of all beasts. It doesn't make us stronger. Some people never fully recover. And as you know, Carmen, in the book, there's a great interview with Frank Peretti. Many of your listeners are familiar with Frank. And he writes about what it did to him well into adulthood, the bullying that he experienced. He said it devastated him. He said it made him a wreck in many ways. And I encourage people to take a look at that because it really, really breaks through. Another misconception we have about bullying is that the bully feels badly about himself or herself, that they have low self-esteem. That has been challenged since the early 70s, and it's gotten worse and worse, I think, in a good way, where more and more research is showing that bullies do not have low self-esteem. Bullies have excessive self-esteem. It is arrogance, it's pride, it's hubris. It is believing that you are more important than others that causes most kids to bully most of the time.
Hey, friends, my conversation partner today is Paul Coughlin. We're going to invite you to check out The Protectors at theprotectors.org. You can also connect with them on Facebook. And we do have books available today. So if this is a subject matter that is important to you and close to your heart, and you would like to enter the drawing for one of our copies of Free Us from Bullying, Real Solutions Beyond Being Nice, you can text us at 877-933-2484, or you can email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com. Paul, one of the words that you used there a minute ago, and I know it's from Nietzsche, but I'm going to use it here as a stepping off point for a conversation about bullies, particularly serial bullies, because it's the word beasts. This is very Darwinian. One of the words that I wrote in the margin, see if I could, you know, this is where, can I find in the book where I wrote something? Maybe not. But you're definitely, it was definitely in one of the paragraphs where you're talking about the serial bully or the bully and how they feel about themselves. And you use this very powerful language about, it's not just that they have self-esteem. They actually like enjoy what they're doing. They enjoy the pain they're inflicting, and they actually don't see themselves as the problem. They see that victim, that wounded person, that weak person as the problem. The target is viewed by them as someone they're actually in the world to destroy. I mean, talk with us a little bit about what's going on in the mind and the heart of the bully.
Yeah, there's studies that will tell us that a bully actually, well, they certainly believe that the target deserves the treatment for fill in the blank, the color of their skin, the way they walk. They might be socially awkward. They don't like the shape of their ears. Honestly, this is how they will dial in on someone to make their life absolutely miserable. Keep in mind that a bully is not looking for a fight. A bully wants to overwhelm. So they only pick on certain kids and not others. And the other thing about, you know, I think if we were honest too, and I've had to become honest on this topic, is that if we all look back on our lives, particularly in school, if we're honest, many of us did experiment with bullying. I know I did. I went after a young lady who had brain surgery when I was in elementary school, and I used to defend her. Her name was Tammy. And one day, I don't know what got into me. I went after her, and I called her a name the way I'd seen my classmates. So, you know, many people have experience with it, and I think we need to be honest. It's pleasurable. Bully, why do bullies bully? Because they can. But then also, most importantly, because they can. We have to make the situation, the environment, to where it's not conducive to bullying. Well, they actually enjoy harming other people. And I just gave you the definition of sadism. So when you said earlier it's very beast-like, it really is beast-like. It represents the worst in human nature. It represents what the medievals called Capiticus, the sin of Capiticus, or the sin of the wolf. Dante writes about this. And this is where people are only valuable in as much as they can be bartered, they can be consumed. So what do bullies barter? Bullies barter the value and dignity of other people for social gain, particularly during the school years. So it really does stem from profound, spiritually dark things. But fighting it, combating it, represents the best in human nature as well.
Okay, friends. So I'm back live with you now. That is a conversation that I had a few months back with Paul Coughlin. He is the author of Free Us from Bullying, Real Solutions Beyond Being Nice. You can find them at theprotectors.org. That's a website, theprotectors.org. You can also find them on Facebook. And I know that in the middle of that recording, it said I have books available, but I don't have any books available anymore. However, if you text me or you email me, I will be sure to respond directly with the website of theprotectors.org so you can, so you can hook up with them in case you're not in a position to take that information down right now. I really wanted to share that conversation again today in honor of the life of a little 10-year-old boy named Seven, and in solidarity with his family and in shared grief with his community and his church and his and most of the people in his school. And I find myself wondering today, because I assure you that the other children on that school bus know exactly who the bully or bullies are. And I assure you that the teachers in that school know exactly who the bully or the bullies are. And so what happens now? Because as you just heard Paul say, what tends to happen is bullies just move from one target to another. When they have successfully overcome one individual, they begin to target another. And so what child now in Jefferson County, Kentucky, is going to be targeted by this bully or bullies that targeted this young boy? So, my heart is broken, and yet I want to equip us for positive action. So please check out theprotectors.org. All right, friends, changing gears now. When we come back, I'm going to be having a conversation with author Nanette Kirsch about her book, Denial, Abuse, Addiction, and a Life Derailed. It's a true story. You don't want to miss it. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Friends, you are listening to Connecting Faith. Welcome back. My conversation partner joining me now is Nanette Kirsch. Among other things, she's an author. But we're going to get to know Nanette a little bit during our conversation today. She's specifically joining us to talk about her book, Denial, Abuse, Addiction, and a Life Derailed. It's based on the true life story of David Wagner. Nanette, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hi, Carmen. Thank you. Glad to be here.
So this is a powerful story with lots of twists and turns and tragedy and some redemption. So I would love for you to, tell people David's story as a way of helping them. We're going to inflame their desire to read the story by telling a portion of it. So I just invite you to tell David's story.
Sure. In brief, the character of David Wagner was based on a good friend of ours who was a very successful person by all outward measures. He had achieved millionaire status in business by the time he was 35 years old. He was married, had five children, was very active in his faith and community, was literally the funniest guy in any room that he went into. He was just a joy to know. And suddenly in 2009, he committed suicide, which was an abrupt and obviously really tragic awakening for everybody who knew him and his family. And it was only in the aftermath of that that a larger story started to unfold about how he was actually living a double life as the result, it turned out, of sexual abuse that he had suffered as a young person. And it basically, his inability to deal with that, his denial, which is obviously why the book has that title, led him into a double life where he struggled with substance abuse, had some very serious sexual addictions, including pornography and prostitution, and was just living a lot of darkness that ultimately succumbed, you know, caused him to succumb.
So story is such a powerful medium. And I think that when any of us imagine sitting down with our friend and inviting them to allow us to tell their story, I mean, that's essentially what you did or what you've done here.
Mm-hmm.
Talk with us about the power of story and really how therapeutic. I'm guessing this was fairly therapeutic for his family as well as maybe for you as his friend.
It was, and that's really the richest part of it. It was very much a God-led journey over more than 5 years. After David died, his widow, who was a good friend of mine as well, called me and said, you need to write a book about this. And I had never written a book, and I didn't really see a story in it because the suffering was so profound. And at that point, I think her interest was in having the world and those around her understand the suffering she had gone through, because it was, as you can imagine, a difficult, somewhat abusive marriage, at least psychologically and emotionally. I didn't really feel called to that, but she had sent me a couple of boxes of documentation that I kept unopened for 5 years. And a couple of years after that initial ask, the Lord called me to really deal with some lingering effects of past sexual abuse that I had suffered. And as I kind of unpacked that for the third time in my life and was fortunate to find a great Christian counselor and really understand the effects it was having in my own life, I saw the effects of denial on myself, the way that I was being denied the fullness of love and trust and intimacy that God calls us into in our closest relationships, especially the one with Him. And so my takeaway was that sexual abuse was a pretty powerful spiritual weapon, and that it separates us from being able to know and trust God, because we don't know and trust anybody as survivors of sexual abuse. You really are afraid to give your heart to anyone fully. And once I understood that, I almost felt God tap me on the shoulder and say, now you have a story to tell. And so I called my friend back. We had been in touch, obviously, but I called her one day and I said, I think I'm ready to tell this story, because for me, it was very personal. This was a dear friend of ours. We loved him. And as I finally understood what had happened in my own life, I wanted to understand why we ended up on different paths. Why did I survive and he didn't? Where was God in his suffering? Because it was very clear through his story and through the journals, which I was so blessed to be able to include in his book, that he always had faith. He always was calling out to God. And so it really was my hope in writing it was to bring some peace to his children as they reached adulthood, that they could put the pieces of their dad's difficult story together in a way that would bless them. And then with their permission and consent, and I didn't decide to publish the book till they, the oldest ones at least had read it and said, yes, we do want to serve a larger audience. Then we published it so that other people who had been impacted by sexual abuse could maybe get this perspective on where God is and something that's so profound and prolific in our culture today.
Friends, my conversation partner is Nanette Kirsch. We are talking about the book Denial, Abuse, Addiction, and a Life Derailed. You can find it at denialbook.com. I think that one of the extraordinary things, Nanette, about this story is that although it is the unique story of an individual, in our culture, it is sadly not a unique story. And David is one of the more than 1,000 victims of clergy right. sexual abuse exposed in the Pennsylvania grand jury report. And so I think that when we when we're talking to our listeners and we're reminding them that the headline news, when there are things like sexual abuse of committed by clergy, committed by priests and other people in authority and religious communities, those are real victims. And those real victims don't just experience that victimization in isolation. It is something that ultimately affects not only their family of origin, but it certainly affects the families that they go on to have in life. Tell me a little bit about what you have learned about the specific nature of abuse when it's spiritual, when it comes from a person in spiritual authority.
Well, I think it's always a spiritual battle, regardless of who perpetrates it, because children are so innocent, right? And they're so trusting, and we're created to trust the love and protection of adults that are put in our pathway as people who are safe and shepherding. You're right. It's especially compounding when it's in the clergy. So, you know, the culture of that time was one that really elevated the clergy in the tradition that he came from, that kind of access and the shepherding toward hopefully a vocation was the very best thing that could happen. And there was a source of pride in, you know, the families to be able to have relationships and engagement and trust with such spiritual leaders. So the violation is even deeper then. I think the only thing that is worse than that is when it happens in a family because of the bonds of trust and leadership there. But yes, I mean, what I saw as I studied my friend's story was just the struggle to unravel God from the evil that had happened. And for anyone familiar with the grand jury report in Pennsylvania or some of the other news reports that have come out, in some cases, the clergy were purposely intertwining that, you know, saying that this is God's will, that symbols of our faith like the cross are used to identify and groom children. So it becomes very complicated to believe in a good God who would allow something like this to happen by people who are supposed to be his shepherds.
So I love that on the Denial Book website, which again, friends, this is the best way to check out what we're talking about today. You can actually read chapter one of the book at denialbook.com. I think that this is a unique thing about you as an author, that you're really offering yourself up to help communities begin this conversation. And, you know, obviously, you know, folks could do your book in a book club, but you're also, you know, equipping people to like start this conversation in their community or in their group or in their church. And even, you know, like that you would come and be the featured person at maybe a fundraising event that they wanted to do for a nonprofit in their community that serves survivors, and promotes prevention and awareness of childhood sexual abuse. I think that's a unique place for you to really serve. And I wanted to lift that up in our conversation today, because you and I are not just here promoting a book. Like, I think that there are sometimes people imagine that that's what we're doing. And really what we're doing, we're trying to say, look, this is a reality that a lot of people deal with and they need help processing it. And if we don't talk about it, if we continue denying that this is a reality in our culture and a reality in the lives of real people who we really love, then they don't have the opportunity to have the light of truth shined upon that darkness. And they live not only in denial, but in shame and in hiding and in fear and believing lies and on and on and on. So talk a little bit about what you feel called to do in this sort of space in our culture right now.
I do think it's so important. And it has definitely become a ministry call for me, even with the book. All of the profits are supporting organizations that help survivors of sexual abuse. I think it's an area that separates so many people from God. One in four women and one in six males, which is something that's often overlooked, will be sexually abused by the time they reach the age of 18. Not everybody suffers the profound impact that my friend did. Not everybody is functional. And I believe firmly that if you've been sexually abused, it's stealing life from you in some place until you confront the impacts and the way that it's hurt your heart and hurt your outlook. You know, for me, it was people pleasing at a really unhealthy level that I needed approval so badly to show my own worth, because my sense of self-worth had been harmed. that it wasn't until I went through therapy, understood how those pieces fit together, and learned to look to the Lord for my worth and my value consistently, that I was able to get out of relationships that sort of replicated that power struggle. So it can be in ways large or small, but they're all important, and the numbers are so prolific that chances are you've either been abused or you love someone who has, and the percent of people who disclose is frighteningly low. So, you know, you look at the Pennsylvania numbers, which are overwhelming, and it's six dioceses. It's reported cases over 20 years, and I firmly believe that doesn't even scratch the surface, and that's only clergy, you know. In my case, I was abused by a lay teacher of the Catholic school that I attended, and so it is a really huge problem. I think in my book and in the conversations and talks that I've been fortunate to be able to share with people, I de-emphasize the specifics of abuse because it is uncomfortable for people, and you can sort of stipulate this is not – it's something that's deeply painful and traumatic. What's more important is building those links that help build understanding about what that looks like. What's the bridge then in adulthood? What are the things that happen that rob people of life? And what can we do, whether we're survivors or we're people who love people who may have been victimized?
Again, friends, my conversation partner is Nanette Kirsch. The book is Denial, Abuse, Addiction, and a Life Derailed. The website is denialbook.com. Nanette, I would love for you to share with our listeners maybe just some ideas and thoughts about how to protect the next generation. How do we protect our families from potential predators? And when we need to say something, who do we say it to?
Two excellent questions. And I've really struggled with the first one because in my case and David's, we came from loving, intact families with engaged family members. And so how does that happen? And I think the reality is at the end of the day, everybody is vulnerable. You're most vulnerable when there's a gap to be filled, you know, when you have parents who aren't engaged or not there. But here's the part that I think parents need to remember is that the most likely predators are the people closest to you, and that's what makes it so hard to recognize that, you know, it's that person close to your family that you can't believe would ever do something like that. And I see it repeated in the headlines. I'll see, you know, priests as this stuff was rolling out in Pennsylvania being accused in their local churches, and the church members saying, no, that can't be. That wouldn't happen. This person's so good. They helped me. They're broken people. They're compelling and charismatic people. And for that reason, they're really hard to identify. And so it's often the stranger beside us. And I think acknowledging that difficult truth is one. I think the other is giving your children voice. One of the things that I've seen in the aftermath of this grand jury report were many, many stories of victims as children speaking out to get help and being brushed off. And I was always under the impression that they didn't tell anybody. They do. And so being attuned to that, giving your children power of voice. One of the examples I use is when my kids were little and we had a babysitter, if they didn't like the babysitter, we never had that babysitter back. I've modeled for them that your voice and your opinion counts. And if you don't feel good about somebody, I don't feel good about them. And so I think that's one thing. And I think the other is having difficult discussions in your family. You know, my kids, unfortunately, have been subjected to a lot of these conversations. And I say unfortunately, honestly, fortunately. They know it's okay to talk about hard things because we talk about hard things. And I think if you create a safe environment and you give your kids the space, they'll share. They'll either share what's happening with them or with people that they care about and give you an opportunity to intervene in a positive way.
Nanette, thank you for being a beautiful, living, substantial demonstration of the gospel. And thank you for this redemptive work. Thank you for the willingness to share your own story. And certainly thank you for sharing David Wagner's story as well. Friends, the book is Denial, Abuse, Addiction, and a Life Derailed. The website is denialbook.com. The author is Nanette Kirsch. Thank you so much for joining us today on Connecting Faith.
Thanks, Carmen.
Friends, I got to take one more quick break. When we come back, I'll be making the connecting point. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge.
We believe in God the Father. We believe in Jesus Christ. We believe in the Holy Spirit.
and he's given us new life.
Hello, friends. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. It is that time of day when we make the connecting point, and it's Friday. So here you go. I decided that today I was going to do a little this is the day that, or on this day in, kind of a thing here at the end of the day. Because I do think it's important to remember that we don't live any day in isolation. Human history is unfolding. God's redemptive plan is unfolding. We are connected in ways that it's really hard for us to sense and imagine. So here you go. It was 100 years ago today. So on this day in 1919, that the Paris Peace Conference following World War II adopted United States President Wilson's resolution for the creation of something called the League of Nations, which was obviously the precursor to what we know of as the UN. And so for whatever problems and angst might exist and concerns about globalism, even as the Davos conference goes on right now in Switzerland, the reality is that 100 years ago, we really needed each other globally in ways that up to that point had not been realized. And so that was just 100 years ago today that the Paris Peace Conference following World War I adopted Woodrow Wilson's resolution for the creation of a League of Nations. Now, most of us are familiar with the song Auld Lang Syne. I don't know if you really know that that's a lang in the middle. And I don't even really know if you know that it's not old. It's auld, A-U-L-D, and that Syne doesn't start with a Z. It's S-Y-N-E. So it's Auld Lang Syne. And it's Scottish. Okay, so today is Robert Burns Day. It's Burns Day. I don't know if you knew that. Why does that matter? People who have a Scottish heritage all over the world are celebrating that today. And what is Robert Burns famous for? Well, he is famous for authoring, although it may have been that he adapted something that was already sort of a part of the world at the time. But he is the one whose name is appended to Auld Lang Syne, the song. So should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should old acquaintance be forgot? And the answer is no. No. We should not forget those with whom we have walked portions of the journey. So tonight there will be all over the world these Burns Night suppers. Now, let me just go ahead and tell you, don't invite me because I don't want to come because I don't want to eat haggis. I have no interest whatsoever in eating, even though I recognize it's a traditional dish, but it's just made of all the parts I don't want to eat. So there you go. Burns is credited with authoring this poem that then, of course, became a song. And so what does Auld Lang Syne mean? Well, it simply means long, long ago. And so what we're encouraged to do here is to remember, not just any memories, but the invitation to remember our dearest and oldest friends, the people because of whose influence we have become who we are today, the people who were there when, fill in the blank. So who was there when whatever those events are over the course of your life really made you who you are? And we're supposed to remember those people today. And not all of those memories are going to necessarily be good, but they should all be substantial. They're all formative. They're all important. And we're talking here about the kind of friendship that David had with Jonathan in the Old Testament. We're talking here about the way David describes Jonathan in 2 Samuel 1:26. Literally a part of his own soul. That he loved Jonathan in a different and even deeper way than he loved a woman. Like we're talking here about a heart friendship that is deep and that is intense. We're talking about the kind of friendship that Jesus is describing in John chapter 15. That he calls us friends. What does it mean to be called a friend of God? That's the kind of deep soul friendship that we're talking about when we are remembering, in the words of Auld Lang Syne on Burns Day. what it means to have walked a portion of the journey with people whose lives really helped us become who we are. So with whom do you have those kinds of soul friendships? The kinds of soul friendships where, you know, that person's got your back no matter what. That heart-to-heart kind of friendship. The people who left an indelible imprint on your soul. Whose friendship shaped you in that way? When I think back, although, you know, at the time, you know, we were just little kids, Dee Dee Wickman and Lori Tepper, these are people in whose fellowship and with whose families I think that my identity was shaped and formed. Fast forwarding to high school, it's certainly the friendships that I had with Kim Stichter and Jessica Lally and, well, it wasn't Jessica Lally at the time, that's her name now. But the heart friendships that you develop with people, and then further along my journey into college and into graduate school, was Marnie, again, Crumpler now, not Crumpler then. And all along, there has been the constant presence of my own sister, who I also consider just this dear, sweet, precious friend at such a heart level. Kathy Connor is a heart friend. Actually, my list of heart friends could be really, really long. I'm rereading Pilgrim's Progress, and it occurs to me that there are these people who sort of wander in and out of our pilgrimage as we make our way toward, in that case, the celestial city. But in the case of each one of us, you know, on our way home to the Father's house, there are people who with whom we walk along the path for portions of the journey, and then, you know, and then they're gone. But they change who we are from the point in time that we encounter them to every point that lies beyond that. And so when we talk about the journey of discipleship, I really want you to think about that today. Who are the people whom you should really be remembering? Remembering them to the Lord, for those who have already gone before us into heaven. Certainly remembering them in your own thought, life, with gratitude to God for the portion of the journey that you shared with them. And then if it be possible, use the technology that's available to actually reach out and tell them that you remember. So that might be one encouragement today, because today is also, by the way, the anniversary of the first transcontinental telephone call made between New York and San Francisco. See, I am full of factoids today. In 1915, on this day, Alexander Graham Bell actually talked to Thomas Watson. They exchanged greetings over what we now call the telephone. And so why not give one of those old friends a call today and celebrate the advent of the technology of the telephone and remember with them the journey or the portion of the journey that you shared together as friends? Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should old acquaintance be forgot and auld ang syne, that is the long, long ago? No. For long, long ago, my dear, this would be the chorus that none of us know. For long, long ago, my dear, and for the sake of old times, for long, long ago, we'll take a cup of kindness yet. For long, long ago, for old lang syne. All right, friends, that's what I got for you today here on Connecting Faith. It is Friday. I want you to have a great weekend. Enjoy the blessings of the Lord. Spend some Sabbath rest with Him. Gather together with God's people, wherever that may be in your community, not only to worship and glorify Him, but to be edified in fellowship with those with whom God intends you be built together as living stones into a cathedral worthy of His name. Have a great day, friends, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.